No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. Welcome, everybody, and welcome, Maria. How are you?
Hello, Michael. I'm great. How are you doing, Michael?
Good. I'm doing great. We're here tonight
looking
to talk about what's
been... Looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, you're coming to Washington. That's a big deal. We're
I'm
excited.
Coming to D.C. Yeah, it'll be my third time in like 13 months or something.
I know. You should just move here and make it easier. Leave that California sunshine and come on out to, good old Washington, D.C. We need good people in Washington, D.C., especially lately.
Why don't we... start on a positive note, which is you're participating in the Rolling Thunder, is it 32?
31 years they've been doing this. And let me tell you a little bit about it. And it is positive. And I've been going every year for 15 years and ride my motorcycle with these guys. But basically what it is it's a bunch of, it was started by a sergeant named Artie Muller, who was from New Jersey and served during the Vietnam War. And Artie started this in 1987 so that we would remember the unaccounted for MIAs and POWs from not only Vietnam, which there are many, but also from the Second World War and Korea. There are almost 83,000 people that have been unaccounted for. Now, most of those have come from the Second World War, but there are still quite a few thousands from the Vietnam War. And he started this rally so that we would never forget these people and that we would continue to do everything we could to search for answers and to find any POWs there may still be some in captivity.
Well, and there's also, they mentioned on their website, which is rollingthunderrun.com, for World War One, they go back as far as.
Wow.
Unaccounted for and unaccepted. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's included in your number that you just shared.
Yeah.
6,000 plus.
And you know what? It's turned into a celebration of patriotism and support for the military. I guess that started to happen when more young people started to get involved. And at first, I think it was almost all Vietnam War era veterans. But, you know, these guys are now in their 60s. And, well, I was in the very last draft lottery for the Vietnam War, and I'm 65. So, you know, the war was, you'd have to be, at least in your 60s to have fought in the Vietnam War. And, now there's a lot of younger people that are involved as well. And it's become a celebration of the military, and it's really cool. All these guys that come in from all over the country to celebrate our military and to say that we'll never forget. And, I know that I'm preaching to the choir here because you're not only a strong supporter of veterans, but you're also a former Harley rider. So correct. You understand what kind of people ride Harleys, you know.
And these aren't just Harley riders, is my understanding.
No, they're not.
It's a motorcycle rally, if you will.
It is a motorcycle rally. And, you know, I'm an old white guy who drives a Harley, you know. I mean, that's I've been driving them since I was a kid, so I think of motorcycles in those terms.
And
funny. It's still.
We ride motorcycles. We don't drive them. We ride them.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just take it back to school. You know, yeah. We didn't even call
them. You and I spoke earlier this week, and I mentioned that I had been to Sturgis twice, which is the world's largest motorcycle rally, and inordinately and predominantly Harleys. But there's the rando, you know, Cross Rockets and the Hondas and et cetera, that, and trikes even, that the older folks ride. And there are women, not many riders. I was one of the few, I hate to say that, but it was true. But I was one of the few female riders under my own power, but there were women that, as they are affectionately called, bitch back, who were with their guts. So,
you're going to be surprised. I'll tell you what, because you're coming to Washington and you're going to be part of this rally, and you're not only going to be surprised how many women you see on motorcycles, you're going to be surprised how many women you see on custom Harleys. There, you know, one thing about Harley Davidson, the thing that saved the company, I don't want to digress here because they almost went out of business, but one of the things that saved them was they realized that everybody that buys a Harley Davidson modifies it. And that's when the company was bought back by the family that started it, and they started to make multiple renditions of Harleys. Instead of making a few models, you know, I don't know how many models they make now, but they make, you know, like 30 plus models, and they make all these aftermarket parts. And you're not only going to be surprised how many women you see, but how many women you see on Harleys that are, you know, like $30,000 and $40,000 Harleys. These people, you know, these women have bought them and customized them. And, you know, you brought up the three wheeler, for example. When I was first starting to ride Harleys, there were a few three wheelers, but the three wheelers were actually called servicars. And they were invented to be vehicles for like meter maids and ice cream vendors and, you know, people like that. And people would buy them and they would modify them and they would do crazy things like put Corvair engines on them and you know, things like that. But now it's a regular model that Harley makes.
Speaking of the family, I actually interviewed Catherine Davidson, who's the granddaughter of the Davidson in Harley Davidson, and she's a writer, and we rode in a rally that ended at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, which is there, was where I interviewed her on camera, and she's got a great legacy with the company. We entitled the episode Born to be Wild, Catherine Davidson. So it was fun to talk to another woman who grew up. It was fun to talk to another woman writer, and this one so happened to be in the legacy of the family.
Well, and you know what, Willie G. Davidson, who I don't know if that's her brother or cousin or who, but they're intimately involved in designing the motorcycles, and they were part of the people that brought it back. Bought the company back. You know, it's a great success story because it was bought by AMF in the 1970s, I guess, and AMF bought it. And if you know AMF, you know they're people that make pool tables and bowling equipment and, you know, stuff like that, other types of...
I think of them, don't they have a partnership with Mercedes-Benz too? Because there's AMF versions of Mercedes.
I don't know. I think that's AMG, and they're a different organization altogether. But But AMF, yeah, they tried to turn it into a family thing. You know what I mean? If you look back and you see all the ads for Harley when they were in charge, there's like mom and dad and little Susie, and they're all out on their Harleys, you know, and they tried to make it kind of a sport. Motorcycling was a sport, but it wasn't until Harley came back and embraced its bad boy image and started putting out, you know, bikes like Road King and Super Glide and, things like that, that the company really started to thrive again after they took it out of the hands of AMF. They also completely retooled. Look, when I had my first Harley, if you could get the thing to go 2 miles without breaking down, that was a big deal. Now they're just like every other motorcycle. You know, you get on them and they start right up and they're reliable and they're, you know, although.
And you know, strange, I've had two, yeah. Michael, and I never once had a problem with either. Not once.
Yeah, that's because you bought them after 1980, when the company had, and I haven't had a problem, knock on wood, with the one I've got now. But that was an advantage. I started riding big Japanese bikes because they were so much more reliable. Hondas, I had a Triumph, too, and that was a very unreliable motorcycle.
Talk about the Rolling Thunder event, because not only are you riding in it, you're actually going to be a part of the event in the dressing after the run.
Yeah, that's the big thing for me. Now, at the height of this event, there were 500,000 Harleys or motorcyclists. Stand corrected. That come into town, and again, much like Sturgis. I don't know what the percentage of Harleys is, but I'm sure it's above 90%. But anyway, there were 500,000 of them that came at one time. And so to address a crowd of that size is just an amazing thing for me. I don't know how big it's going to be. And I also want to, it's an opportunity for me to say, hey, look, we'll never forget the unaccounted for. We'll always, fly those POW MIA flags and remember them and what we do. But there's also many, many issues that we need to address for veterans today. For example, I haven't checked lately, but the last time I checked, one out of every three homeless people in the District of Columbia is a veteran. I mean, that's horrible. There should be no such thing as a homeless veteran. There should be no such thing as a homeless veteran.
Too, Michael, because they make the distinction. They don't just call it Rolling Thunder. They're calling it Rolling Thunder 32 First Amendment Demonstration Run.
Right. Well, that's it, right? And that's what I want to stand up and say. This is a First Amendment run. You're here exercising your right to petition the government. But you know what? There are 30,000 veterans right here in the District of Columbia that I represent that do not have the right to petition their government. They have a First Amendment right, but they don't have the basic right to representation, which even precedes the First Amendment, right? That's the first right of democracy is a right to vote for somebody to represent you. And these 30,000 brave men and women who have fought and stood up for this country have no voting representation in either House of Congress. So that's really what I want to say to these guys. I want to say there are many issues out there, and this is a very important veterans issues. So keep on coming back on Memorial Day weekend. And if you can't come back for this issue, let's come back for the other issues that involve veterans, which include statehood for the District of Columbia so that these veterans can be represented. And let's see if we can get them to keep on coming. You know, the reason that's been given for ending the rally is that there's not enough local cooperation, and there aren't enough sponsors, you know, people willing to sponsor this. Well, I think we can find, we can get the locality to cooperate, because statehood is an important issue for us, and this is an important constituency for us. And I think we can, you know, if I don't know why Harley doesn't sponsor this. I don't know why other bike companies don't support this, because so many other people show up. I don't know why there's not support, more support from this or any other administration. I don't know why there's not more support from the District of Columbia. So I'd like to work on that, and I'd like to get involved with these people, because, you know, veterans are one of our strongest groups in terms of fighting for our rights, right? Because it's right. It's hard to tell somebody, an American citizen, taxpaying citizen, that they don't deserve the same rights as everybody else. But it's even harder to say that to a veteran, somebody that stood up for their country, somebody that's, you know, put everything on the line for our democracy. It's even harder to say to them, you don't deserve the same rights as somebody that's never served. So that's going to be my pitch to these people, and hopefully they'll respond and say, yeah, this is something that we should all be involved in. This is something that affects veterans everywhere. Because, you know, I believe, as Dr. King believed, that you know, that this affects, you know, any violation of people's equal rights anywhere affects all of us everywhere. So I'm hoping that we can get them to stand up. And they're stand-up people. I believe they will.
Itself, yeah. Is Sunday, May 26th, and they start assembling as early as 6 o'clock in the morning, but they roll out at 12 noon. And you said it can sometimes take an hour and a half to get out of the parking lot.
Yeah, it takes a long time to get out of the Pentagon parking lot.
And luckily, then at 1:30 is when you're speaking at the Lincoln Memorial. That's the Rolling Thunder Speakers program.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to let our listeners know, if there's events Friday, Saturday, and Monday also, but the ride itself is Sunday, May 26th, which is the week from today.
That's right.
There's a musical tribute to the veterans, too, and a concert at the Capitol.
Yes, and there are events all weekend that start. It starts with the blessing of the bikes at the National Cathedral on Friday. Yeah.
Have you ever participated in that?
No, but I plan to this year.
I think that would be really touching.
Yeah, my only problem with it is that I also have a long-standing engagement on Friday where I'm part of a panel on statehood, but I'm gonna try to make them both. I don't know how long the blessing of the bikes takes, but I'm gonna try to do that. And you know, I've been invited this year to ride in with the leadership, so that's great. You know, I've got to go do a few things to my bike tomorrow and make sure it's in tip top shape. So you know, you'd hate to break down, right? But anyway,
so that's awesome that you're not only writing, but you're participating and you're going to be addressing. And I have the honor and the privilege to be there with you and to watch you, because I know that you're captivating when you speak.
I hope that's true.
I don't know if it's anything like what Sturgis was, but at there was a couple venues that held the major events, and one of them was the one where I broadcast from in the mornings. I had my morning show at the time. And then in the afternoon and evening, people would start arriving who had paid for the concerts, because every night they had a different musical act come in. And it's the Velvet Revolvers and the ZZ Top and, you know, those kinds of performers. And everyone would ride into the park. It was a grassy area where the concerts where a stage was put up, but then it was like festival style seating, but most people sat on their bikes to watch the concert, and instead of clapping, they would rev their engine.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they'll. I mean, the stage, from what I understand, is going to be in front of Lincoln Memorial. So it's going to be on the Mall. It's actually right. That's right. You know, that's where the great civil rights speeches of the 1960s were given. Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream speech, for example. But, and lots of the activities revolve around the Vietnam War Memorial. There's also the Korean War Memorial, the Second World War Memorial, all there right on the Mall. So a lot of the veterans will be there on their motorcycles. It's really hard to get a spot if you're not in the initial run. It's really hard to get a spot anywhere near the Lincoln once the festivities really start, once the speeches start.
I would imagine.
Because so many people are around the Vietnam Wall, and they're all right there adjacent to the Lincoln Memorial.
Where there's a candlelight vigil at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, that's on Friday night. But on Monday, they have many wreath lane ceremonies.
Yes.
At the World War II Memorial, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, the Vietnam's Veterans Wreath Lane, et cetera. So it really is a patriotic, as you mentioned in the opening, event. And how great that the District of Columbia is the one to host it. Well, you're not hosting it.
Yeah.
It's being hosted in D.C.
Yeah, well, you know, and let me just say this about on Monday, there'll be all sorts of things going on. I'm sure I'll be involved in some of them. But, Arlington, there'll be a lot going on Arlington Cemetery, of course. And if you've never been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and the changing of the guard, it's an amazing thing to watch because it's absolutely silent. There are people there. From, lots and lots of people come to see this, and it's absolutely silent, and it gives you a moment to reflect on really the sacrifices that have been made so that people like you and me can sit on the internet and talk about things, or so we can go about our business every day, and not have to worry, so that we can live in a country where you can express the way you feel, and no matter what you say, you don't have to worry about going to jail or running afoul of the government, that you have rights that are ensconced in the Constitution, and
someone else has fought for.
Right. And, we often say, unfortunately, I deal with veterans all the time, and unfortunately, we always say that freedom isn't free. But a lot of times we forget to thank the people that paid for it. It isn't free, but it's really been paid for with a lot of human sacrifice. And unfortunately, sometimes when these people come home, they're not treated the way they should be treated. Certainly Vietnam veterans weren't. When my father came home from the Second World War, America said, thank you. Thank you. Let me give you a GI Bill. Let me help you buy a house. Let me help you find a job. Let me help you get an education. Let me say thank you for what you did for us. And you know what? We built a middle class on the GI Bill. I can't tell you how many people I knew growing up whose parents had been educated on the GI Bill, or who bought their first house because of the GI Bill. A lot of my parents' friends, that was true. And we built a middle class on America. On the back of government involvement in the lives of veterans, and I don't know where that's gone, but we need to get it back. We need to respect these people and take care of these people. And you know what? If you have a job and you're out there looking for somebody, I can't imagine not wanting to hire a veteran. These are people that have already stood up for something. They've already shown that they're loyal and responsible and committed people. And if I was hiring people, they're the first people I would look at. And I can't believe, it really troubles me that their jobless rate is higher than the national average, that you know, we don't do enough for PTSD. I know that's something you know a lot about. We don't do enough for, you know, we don't take care of them well enough. And in D.C.,
you know, when
it's
I was
terrible.
Getting my master's, though, Michael, at Pepperdine, there were more than a handful of, like, Iraq and Afghanistan veterans that were there on the GI Bill. And one of the men told me he also had a service dog with him, an emotional support dog that had unfettered access to everywhere he went. And he said that not only was his tuition paid for, but his compensation was increased to incentivize them to go and get an education. So he was actually making more money per month to be in school and having the tuition taken care of. So I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, that's great. And you know what? I know that my brother, who's a veteran, a combat veteran, that was much, you know, my brother went into the Air Force with a bachelor's degree, became an officer. They trained him to fly a F-111, but in his spare time, they also paid for him to get a doctorate in education from Vanderbilt. So when he retired at the ripe age of about, I don't know, he was in his early 40s. He put his 20 in. And when he retired, he went on to become president of a college and just retired from that. So I know that there used to be great benefits, and it's nice to hear that there's still good benefits because,
yeah, you know, I don't know if it's specific to the branch he was in, the one that I was just referencing. He was in the Marines, and he graduated with me with his master's degree in clinical psychology, and I was thinking, can you imagine what a great therapist he might make? Talk about life experience on both, you know. So, I mean, I thought that was good. And we have a couple good news stories before we get into the Alabama abortion law and the heartbeat law. But Dr. Sanjay Gupta yesterday, who is a correspondent on CNN, he interviewed Kevin Hines, who you and I interviewed before, because Kevin is one of the few who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. And Dr. Gupta had interviewed him earlier. I think I've interviewed him at least three times. I've met him in person. But Kevin's life mission has been to put a net around the Golden Gate Bridge to catch anybody that does jump. And the net has finally gotten approval, and it's being installed, and it will be in effect on 2021. And Dr. Gupta was promoting it and revisiting with Kevin Hines. And I just wanted to say to you, if you hadn't seen that, that if you recall, he was a very gracious and incredibly brave and inspirational guest on our program.
Well, I do recall him, of course. I didn't know that the net was finally going up. So that is good news. And, you know, that's just right. We're cutting edge here at Shadow Politics. We not only that's not the only good news that's going around. I have a little good news, and that is that a few weeks ago, we were one of the first shows, I think, to interview presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. And Marianne Williamson has gotten 65,000 individual contributions. Well, she hasn't made it, unfortunately. We just found this out, that she got 65,000 individual contributions, which is just amazing. It's amazing when you think about it. But now the DNC is also requiring that you have at least 1% of support when they do polling from various polls. Now, this has been problematic for her because there are certain polls that have been conducted, nationwide polls, where she hasn't been included. So it's hard to and it's hard to get support, right, if you're not in the poll. So she pushed very, very hard the last few weeks to qualify on the 1%, because they've now decided, the DNC, that they're only going to have a maximum of 20 candidates involved in the debate, but they have more than 22 running now. They have 22 running. So a couple of people are going to be left out. and she doesn't want to be left out, and I don't blame her. And I hope if you're out there, you know, you'll consider going to her website seeing what you can do to help her get that 1%, because she's an important voice. I mean, let's be honest.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I agree with you, and I was really impressed with her interview with us. But I mentioned her just this week to somebody, and they said, "Who's that?" And I wanted to say, "You're kidding, right?" And of course I didn't, but I don't know why she wouldn't be more well-known. I mean, she was an international best-selling author for 30 years.
Which not a lot of the other candidates
can say. You know, they may be politicians, but she, I mean, the world knows of her and her work. And then the fact that she's running for president, that this person didn't know who I was talking about. And I thought, oh man, she must have a struggle then with name recognition.
Well, yes, she does. I mean, I haven't mentioned her to anybody that knows her. And here in Washington in politics, I mentioned that she's on the show, and I mention her name, and people don't, for the most part, don't know who she is. And then when I say who she is, I give a few of her credentials, there are some people that go, "Oh, yeah, I've heard of her." But initially, they don't know her, who they are and who she is. And you have to remember that to be accurate, polls need to be random. So they just choose people randomly. Some may not even be voters. And let's be honest, you know, remember when Jay Leno used to go out on the street and interview people, and a third of them didn't know who the president was. Who didn't know who the first president was. You know, some of the simplest questions, that, you know, the kind of questions they ask you on a citizenship test. I remember he went out, you know, and they ask you pretty straightforward questions on a citizenship test. You know, what is the Constitution? Who's the first president? Blah, blah, blah. And a third of the people he came across on the streets in New York didn't know what he was talking about. So, that doesn't much.
Yeah, but if she's not even on the poll, then she's not even in the discussion.
Right. Because, right, our media people decide who's important and who's not important. And that's something that shouldn't be. That shouldn't be either. You know, yeah. I mean, right. She herself admits that she's a terrible long shot. But the process of nominating and electing a president and having a campaign that's going to go on, it's starting now. It's starting in June. So it's going to go on for 18 months here in the United States. It'll be headline news. And having that process is more than just electing a president. It's about also getting issues on the table that become important. I saw Senator Bernie Sanders on this morning, a guy on Meet the Press, a guy that I love. I think he's just the greatest guy. And he was talking, they talked about his 2016 campaign. And he said, you know, we brought issues to the forefront, which are now major issues that we're talking about, things like healthcare. And so our campaign really accomplished something. And, you know, that's why I think it's important to support people like Marianne Williamson, because they have important things to say and important things that we need to consider. It's like, you know, this woman that's all the rage now on the Democratic side, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. There's a lot of things I don't agree with AOC. Okay, many, many things I don't agree with. But, well, I wouldn't say many, many, but several things I don't agree with. But she's an important voice. She's a young voice. She's saying some important things. And we need that. We need people that have been around for a long time and have experience. But we also need to hear from young people. And, you know, she said, she made a comment that I really agreed with, that people in regular people in America need to be represented by regular people. And I think that that there's some truth to that. I don't think that we want our Congress made up completely of, you know, regular people or blue collar people or working class people. But we do. But they do have to be there, and they do. They are an important part of the mix. So and I think by the same token, Marianne Williamson is a person that we need to hear what she has to say, and she needs to be part of the mix. So if you're out there and you're listening and you care about making sure that all sides, all interests are represented in the presidential debate, see what you can do to support Marianne Williamson. She's not my candidate for president, but she is an important voice. Now let's talk about, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, Alabama, and the new abortion law. But let me just say this before we begin, because you are my Republican co-host, I think that this is crazy political strategy going into an election year. There are 8 states that have passed new laws to limit abortion, and they are Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Arkansas, Utah, Ohio, Kentucky, and Missouri. And you know what those 8 states have in common? Donald Trump won each and every one of those 8 states in 2016. And we all know that one of the reasons that Donald Trump won was that a lot of women voted for him. Now, I'll tell you what, he's not making friends with women in those states.
Romney have said they disagree with the Alabama law because they agree with the exemptions for rape, incest, or the health of the mother.
Well, and you know what?
Public with
and,
that.
I'm not saying this is a Republican problem. I'm saying this is,
well, because there's a Democrat governor that's going to sign it, he said, when it gets to his desk this week.
I know.
I forget what state he's in.
But you understand politically, if anything, this is going to drive women to the polls. And I just think they're making a serious mistake to do this right now.
It's a mistake, period. I think that abortion is murder. It's a life. It's not a tree. It's not a flower. It's not a mammal. It's a life. But I also believe that it's not my responsibility to legislate for any other woman than her conscience and her body and her choice. And I would never want Roe v. Wade to get thrown out for that reason. And I'm Catholic, and I know that sounds like I'm speaking out of both sides of my mouth, but I have a girlfriend who, she had a backyard abortion over 50 years ago, back alley abortion, and the story she tells is chilling about what she had to go through in the Northeast to get that, and fortunately she had the support of her mother and grandmother who facilitated it, and this is a woman who's 72 years old today. So it was illegal when she had hers. And no one should have to go through what she went through. And fortunately, it wasn't the coat hanger thing, but it was seedy and dark and scary and illegal.
Well, and you know what? I think for me, it's such an easy thing because I'm a man, you know, and I take responsibility for that. It's easy for me to say, it doesn't, you know, it's not a decision that really should involve me because it doesn't affect me as a human being. So that's really kind of a cop out, I think, on my part. But it's easy for men to say, look, this is not our issue. It's an issue. It is up to women to make these decisions about their own bodies. But I also understand why when you say that you believe it's a life, I understand that, and I understand why it's such a tough decision, and I think we need to sit down and talk about it rationally, and I can't do it because I'm a man, but I think women...
Yeah, but men are the ones that have created the situation mostly.
Of course.
Not women. So that's the irony of it, is, yeah, it's not your body, but you're the ones legislating this.
Yes.
It doesn't make any sense. And granted, I've already said how I feel about it, my morals and my values. But again, I have the clarity that it's not my decision. I have a decision for my body. I don't have the right to make that decision for any other woman.
Well, and you know, and it's not only if you take the if you look at the picture of the men that passed this in Alabama. Yeah, it's very ironic, you know, that we have control, you know, that they have control over laws like this. But is there any doubt in anybody's mind? Look, if you're out there listening and you have a problem with this, call and tell me. But if this was if men got pregnant, this wouldn't even be an issue. It wouldn't even be an issue. It would have been resolved a long time ago. It's only an issue because it affects women, you know, physically.
Which is a sad statement to make.
It's a sad statement. Right.
It's ridiculous. Now, late-term abortions, I have more of a moral issue with that. Now you're talking about something that's exceedingly viable outside the fetus. But I had a vaginal ultrasound when I was 7 weeks pregnant with my daughter. So I've seen the fetal heartbeat at 7 weeks. I knew that I was pregnant because I was trying to get pregnant. She's my fourth. And I was aware. But I know that most women 8 or 10 weeks down the line into their first trimester, they don't know that they're pregnant. I skipped a period, or, you know, I've been erratic, or, you know, I didn't think about it, or I didn't have any symptoms or whatever. So that's where the problem is that it's not that somebody knows they're pregnant and then they do it. It's that they don't know that they're pregnant and they find out and it's too late under this heartbeat legislation.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember that Pat had, what is the test? Is it amniocentesis? Or she had some test because with our last child, because she was, I can't remember how old she was, approaching 40. She was approaching 40. She was in her mid-30s, I guess, and that's just a standard test that they do. Right. You know, and we certainly, you know, had a discussion about it. What will we do if the test showed that, you know, there might be some problems with the fetus? And, you know, so certainly we decided that it wouldn't matter to us, you know, that we would carry the pregnancy. Yeah,
right.
We would carry the pregnancy
on. And I did that same decision too. Because you have the amnio at 16 weeks, so you're 4 months pregnant. And what I said to my husband was, why should we bother? Because we know we're not going to do anything to terminate. And then I said to him, why not get the information? Because if there is a situation, we can prepare the three brothers that we may have a special needs child or whatever the situation may be, then emotionally we're, you know, already jiggy with it. We could have experts around during the delivery or, you know, what have you, whatever the malady might be, you can be prepared and pre-warned. And that was the only reason that I agreed to it, was I wanted the knowledge so that we could do something as a family with that information, not to terminate.
Well, you know, I certainly agree with that. And, you know, I think Pat, I can't speak for Pat, but certainly for me, I think children are in fact a gift from God. You know, when they're teenagers, you kind of wish that God had a better return policy, you know, that you could take it back and get a full refund. Or, you know, as I say to young parents all the time, I say, let me tell you, they're not a good investment. You're not going to get back what no. you put into them in terms of money. But in every other respect,
and emotions.
But even though I would argue with the rationality that you use that drove you to have four children, I would encourage anybody to do it. They really are a gift, and they're certainly the highlight of my life. And I know that,
indeed.
That you feel similarly.
Absolutely, but you're right. It's not easy, and it is challenging at times, especially as you mentioned when they are teenagers, which is perfectly developmentally appropriate, and we need them to go through that, or else they become aberrant adults, and we don't want that.
Right.
But it is, sometimes, especially with my daughter, man, our relationship got toxic as she got to 18 and was about ready to graduate. And she really wanted that independence. And I was like, you're still a minor. You still live under my roof.
Right.
You still have to obey my rules. You still right. have a curfew. You right. still have restrictions on your amount of cell phone usage. And she was like, that's child abuse. And I was like,
yeah.
I think that you have the wrong term for what it is. It's called parenting and boundaries.
Well, they think that's what they think child abuse is, parenting. I mean, I remember one of them standing up and pounding her fist on the table and giving me a lecture how she was an adult and how I couldn't tell her what to do. And then coming back 10 minutes later and reminding me, because she was in college, that her rent was due. And I said, you know what? You're an adult. Yeah, you almost feel sorry for him, right? And,
yeah.
and I said to her, you're an adult when you reach into your pocket and you pull out your own money. I mean, until you're
right.
doing that, you
right.
know, I'm the big boss. And I mean, she just looked at me like I had two heads. Like, where would this guy come up with
yeah.
an idea
yeah.
like that? But, you know, I also used to exercise the adolescent mantra of I didn't ask to be here. And my father always used to say to me, feel free to check out at any time. You know,
if you didn't ask to be here. When they don't give you, because my eldest, when he was in high school, who all of my kids were clean cut and I didn't have to deal with the law enforcement or drugs or alcohol or sex or any of that. So, but they weren't goody two shoes. They were normal, but still. He wanted
yeah,
to get his ears pierced and a tattoo. And I said, not on my watch. You know, when you're an adult and you can afford it and you want to pay for it, then you make that decision then, but not when you're in my home. And I don't have a problem with those things. And as it turns out, he never did the piercings, but he got a tiny little tattoo when he was at USC of his fraternity's slogan, which is right above his ankle. So you can't even see it. And it's like, honor, dignity, respect, and valor. And I was like, that's awesome.
Well, yeah, right. But, you compromise, right? At that point, you just want to make sure everything's spelled right. That's really
yeah. It was the Greek letters for those two. And so it's just four little things, and it's just above his ankle. I happened to notice it one day when he had flip-flops on. You know, he was 20-something by the time I saw it. He never even showed it to me when he did do it. And I was like, that's great. Good for you.
Well, you
yeah,
know what?
Not on my watch and not in my budget.
My daughters, both, you know, one of them has a very small tattoo. One of them has several of them. And, you know, I feel the same way. I'm like, oh, my God. Now they're all over 21. I don't have any under 21 anymore. So, you know, and I did everything. I fought when they were young. I wouldn't let them do it. And, you know, I would say things to them like, you know, you have to join the Navy before you're allowed to get a tattoo and blah, 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 you know, and they would laugh at me. But yeah, you know, you do what you can. And this is one of the things about getting older. It's harder sometimes to accept the changes that, you know.
I've always said that if it's consenting adults and animal and children aren't in the equation, then so be it. But, you know, we've done our job, and now it's their turn to live their life the way they want to. And I hope that they're happy and fulfilled. But speaking of colleges, I don't know if you heard that over the weekend, the speaker at Morehouse College, he paid off the entire student debt for the 396 graduating senior.
Oh my God!
It's $40 million that he's paying.
Who was the speaker?
It's Robert F. Smith. He's worth $5 billion, and according to Forbes, he's the richest black person. And he also got an honorary degree when he spoke. But they were saying that the kids were going, he's kidding, right? Is he serious? And then the dean or the president said, nope, he's serious. He's paying off all of your student debt.
Well, hell yeah, they gave him a degree. I'd give him a degree for $40 million. That's all, you know, that's more than the Hollywood stars paid to get their kids into good schools.
Yeah.
No, that's great that he did that, and I hadn't heard that. And thanks for that good news. And we're almost out of time here. You know, this always happens when it's me and Maria. We have so much to talk about. But
we do. Well, and then we have to mention Taiwan approving gay.
Right. And I was just going to say that.
On Friday.
That yesterday, one of the great things was I got to go to the Chinese dragon boat races. I've done this for 7 years. I've been somebody that goes down and helps officiate. I do the ribbon cutting, and there's a lot of ceremonial stuff that goes on. And it's put on by the U.S. Taiwanese Cultural Association. And, of course, that was the big news, that Taiwan has legislated for gay marriage, for same-sex marriage, and they're the first people in Asia to do this, the first country in Asia. So God bless them for standing up for gay people and being the first. It's never easy to be the first. And on that note, let me just...
That I've seen of the crowds that have been outside their parliament building while they were making the decision is so heartwarming to think that they don't have to be silenced anymore, and they don't have to live in shame anymore, and they can be who they are. I mean, it's just, it's like so heartwarming that, yay, they get admitted to society like we've been able to do with ours, our cultures.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great note to end it on. And let me just say that tonight we're going to leave you with a song from Blind Faith. If you're old enough to remember who Blind Faith is, you're pretty old. But this is for all the unaccounted for soldiers that have stood up for America. Let's not ever forget them. The song is entitled Can't Find My Way Home. And we'll see you next week, America.
Yes, and thank you for listening. We appreciate the opportunity to be a part of your experience.
Give the people their right to vote.